Welcome to Kentish, the Formula Ford podcast. I am Jacques Driesing. This is episode 10, and with me today is Todd Gerstenberger. Todd is a phenomenal young racer. I say young, he's my age, out of California. And without prolonging it any further, Todd, welcome to Kentish.
Thanks for having me on. I love that you're doing this. When you first brought it up, I was excited that, you know, something like this was going to be out there. You know, and I had visions of if it made it, maybe the third or fourth season, you'd ask me to be on to talk about it. So the fact that I, you know, made the top 10, I'm one of the first 10 on it, is pretty exciting for me, honestly.
Well. And to put you in right standing, you are a substitute this week. I actually had a sponsor come on so I could do an overseas phone call this week, and that is going to now be next week. But congratulations on making it to the top 10.
So yeah, I'll take it. You know, in racing, we say it's better to be lucky than good, right?
Or what was it? Jean-Pierre Sarti was, there is no wrong way to win. There is only winning. So
exactly.
Okay, so Todd, you are from California. Where are you originally from, and where do you live now?
So I was born in Santa Barbara, about 3 hours north of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was three, we moved to the beautiful city of Manhattan Beach, mm-hmm. Where I spent all of my formative years until I left for college, went to Cal Poly Pomona, and then moved near there. And I didn't really move back to the beach, one, because it's really expensive,
mm-hmm.
And two, because with this whole race car thing, I've always, you know, had a dream of having a shop on my own property.
Yeah.
And that is not even close to remotely possible near the beach, so moving about an hour inland to somewhere that's a little less congested has let me at least buy a piece of property that I can put a shop on.
Yeah.
Don't have the shop built yet, but that's the goal.
Excellent. Excellent. And when you went to school, what'd you major in?
Mechanical engineering.
Okay. So you're tracking right along. It makes sense. Yeah.
Exactly. I knew from an early age, you know, I was born into race cars, and always had an interest in mechanics and mechanical, and you know, even toyed with the thought of just being a mechanic. But I wanted to do something lucrative enough that I would, you know, be able to race when I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And so it pushed me to get my degree, and it's done very well for me, and I've got to, you know, move up professionally quite well, and it allows me to have a family life that I love and get to race.
Yeah. So given your family's background, how was it you got into the sport of auto racing?
Well, like I said, I was born into it. My dad has been around racing his whole life. He raced the Royale in the very early formative years of Formula Ford.
Mm-hmm.
By his admission, you know, didn't do particularly well. he has the same struggle that you and I have of being, you know, slightly larger gentlemen.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So there's a weight penalty there, and It, you know, he spent a couple years doing it, and then moved on to other things. When I was born, just after I was born, he acquired a Lotus 26R,
mm-hmm.
which was full SCCA prep when he got it. You know, big monster flares on it, and you know, chin spoiler and all that, which he then put back to standard 26R spec, and went vintage racing with it,
mm-hmm.
and was very successful with it, won a number of C production championships. He ended up being the president of VARA, the local mm-hmm. vintage club, for a number of years. So I spent all my formative years at the racetrack, you know, being a mechanic, turning wrenches, just loving being at the track and being around the track family. So that's what got me introduced to the track. I then, you know, showed interest in racing, did a little bit of karting. In my youth, went to the Jim Hall Karting School. Didn't do a ton of it,
yeah.
But was always ready to start racing as soon as I could. So we were, when I was, you know, 15, 16, about when I could start racing, we were putting together a Lotus Cortina for me to begin my vintage racing career in. And we were probably about 2 months from having it done. And then somebody... A guy who had decided he needed a Lotus Cortina to race came to, he said he just wanted to look at ours to see how we were putting it together. And he came in and he looked at it. He spent an hour going over the whole car, and then he, you know, came to my dad and said, "I want to buy it. How much?" And my dad said, "Oh, it's not for sale. Mm-hmm. You know, this is for my son." And the guy said, "Oh, okay, what's just a crazy number on it?" And so my dad threw out a crazy number, and the guy said, "I'll go get my checkbook." So that car went away, which caused some strife and our, you know, home life for a few weeks, but we made up. And then at about the same time, I don't actually remember if we got the Elan before the Cortina sold or just after, but another old, terrible, torn-up SCCA Elan was offered to us for a very reasonable price. And it was so torn up that my dad had seen the pictures and said, "No thanks."
Yeah.
And the guy kept bugging us and kept bugging us because it was sitting in his backyard and he wanted to get rid of it. And so he said, "Tell you what, it was in Arizona. I'll haul it out to you. And it comes with a trailer too." And the trailer was probably a better part of the deal than the car. So my dad finally relinquished and said, "All right, we'll take it." The guy delivered it and we got it. And it was even worse than the pictures. It was just terrible. The SCCA, you know, wide flares were pretty much solid resin. You know, they weren't something that you can usually just take a hammer and knock fiberglass flares off. These each had to be ground off.
Yeah.
But once we got it, you know, back down to the frame and body, it was a pretty nice car.
Hmm.
And so we put it together, and my dad, you know, his 26 car was a part at the time we were doing that, because it had been in a fairly major crash, and after he crashed that, he focused on some other cars. So I could really, you know, study it and go through what all the factory race car tricks were and implement all those into the car I was building. So I got it together, and that was the first car I raced, was that Lotus Elan, and I ran it for a number of years and had a lot of success with it.
And that said, your family was great friends with someone very close to the Lotus brand. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so my dad, during the Santa Barbara years, and actually before my dad moved up to Santa Barbara, was very close friends with Dave Bean, Dave and Roberta Bean.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually my godparents, and they're well known in the Lotus vintage community because they've founded Dave Bean Engineering,
right,
which was the parts dealer for North America for vintage Lotus parts. So my summers during high school, the way I would earn money to make it through the year, you know, aside from my allowance, was I would go up to San Andreas, California, and work in the machine shop at Dave Bean Engineering as a machinist apprentice, and helped him put together the yellow 26 car that he ran, you know, before he passed, and it was good. It was a lot of fun, and that also gave me a lot of other insight about what you can do to an Elan to make it fast. Is that that car had some pretty pretty sneaky things on it. I don't know where that car is now, so I'm not going to admit any of the really trick stuff that Dave did to it, because I don't want to blow anybody's cover.
The chef never admits what's in the pudding, so.
Exactly.
Wow. So, how did you get into Formula Ford action?
So, I'd always had an interest in single-seater race cars. My dad, you know, he spent time in Formula Fords, and after he wrecked the Elan, the 26R, he put together a 5000 car that he bought previously and had been working on restoring, and started racing that. And I always just looked at single-seater race cars as kind of the end-all, be-all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my engineering mind, a production car, you're starting out with something not where it was meant to be. If you're taking a production car racing,
yeah,
you're making a whole bunch of compromises, and a lot of it is building to a rule book. You know, how much can you get away with?
Right.
My Elan, I spent a lot of time re-engineering parts because I had a TIG welder and a mill and half of an engineering degree at that time, because I was still in college when I was racing it competitively. So I spent a lot of time redesigning suspension pieces and welding things up and seeing if it worked and everything. And, you know, I never got to the point of moving suspension pickup points, because that's really you know, a no-no against the rules. Mm-hmm. But I also knew that nobody was really looking that close, so I could probably get away with it. And that always kind of didn't sit right with me, because it's just a compromise, and it's how much can you get away with.
Right.
So I always wanted to do single-seater stuff. And I really always liked Formula 4 because of the great community. But no matter where you go, Formula 4 has a great community. So I brought it up a number of times to my dad, and in the beginning he was, you know, pretty against it, just due to the safety factor of putting a, you know, 20-year-old kid who thinks he can take on the world in a car that has six tubes, you know, around your body, and that's about it. Not that a Lotus Elan has a whole lot more structure to it or substance to it,
yeah.
But it's a modicum of safety, I guess. But then finally, after, at the time in the vintage scene in C production, it was tough because there were a lot of guys running Porsches. That's what I was running against was 911.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just becoming a spending war.
Yeah.
And they were just investing in motors and investing in motors. And I remember a rumor going around about one guy having just built a new motor for $90,000.
Yikes.
And I just remember thinking, my God, I can't keep up with that. And that's not where I want to go anyway. I don't want to make, you know, this poor little Elan just, you know, all of today's technology and not how it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a race at Phoenix, and I was fast, and then I broke a rear hub. Thankfully, it fit on the car, so the car didn't, you know, go mm-hmm. sideways or into a wall or anything.
Yeah.
But again, it was something where, you know, it's an overstressed, you know, old car from 1965. And I finally, when I broke at that race on the Sunday race, I said, "That's it. I'm done with this. I'm going to get a Formula Ford."
Yeah.
And so I started looking, and I found a Titan that was, you know, quote unquote race ready, and it was pretty close. There was most of it was right, though. So I'm very finicky with my stuff, so I, you know, spent 2 weeks. I got 2 weeks before the first time I raced it, and spent those 2 weeks changing, you know, everything I could touch on it.
Sure.
That was my first race in Formula Ford, which was a very humbling experience. You know, I'd won a lot racing that Elan, and I had a pretty big ego coming in. I'll freely admit now,
mm-hmm.
Thinking that, man, I'm really going to set the Formula 4 world on fire. These guys are not going to know what hit them.
Yeah.
And went out the first weekend, and it was a 30-car field. I qualified like 20th.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty humbling. And there were some, I wouldn't call them bad habits, but some things that I learned to do racing that Elan that did not translate well to a vintage Formula Ford. You know, we in order to make Elan go fast, we set them up with a very stiff limited slip
mm-hmm.
Differential,
yeah.
And then we used the throttle like an off-on switch mid-corner to rotate the car. And that works great for that, especially when you have, you know, the limited slip like that. But a Formula 4 is an open diff, and if you mid-corner decide to jump off the throttle and back on it, you have just created a whole world of hurt for yourself.
Right.
So it took a couple years to really get to the point where I was, you know, back just challenging all the time at the front. So it was humbling, but it was also a great learning experience, and I don't regret doing it one bit.
Yeah, and I've heard that from everyone. You learn the most getting behind your first single seater. And I say this, I came from karting. I did that for a decade. And then I did Spec Miata for about 4 years. And
mm-hmm.
when I first jumped in the Eagle, and I know that scares a lot of people to think that the first Formula car I ever got into was an Eagle. I realized it was so much like a kart that I completely forgot about everything I ever did in Miata racing. And it was so weird because, you know, you're strapped in and you're confined. And as we mentioned, I'm not a small lad. Where feeling the response, the throttle response, the way the car was bending through a corner, it was a kart to me. And so that was easy to erase. Now, granted, a 26R versus a Miata are two different creatures from two different planets. So I look at there. I didn't enjoy my Miata days, and I didn't really learn how to drive a Miata properly. So luckily, I got to erase that really, really quickly. So okay.
That worked out, right?
Yeah. So you start out with your Titan. Let's go through the laundry list of other Formula Fords that have entered your life through the years.
Sure. So I had the Titan about year three of running it. I was involved in a fairly serious wreck. Somebody spun right in front of me in turn five at Willow, which is, you're going at a fairly rapid clip there. And I was really sure I was going to miss him right up until I hit him. And my left, he was, you know, three quarters of the way backwards, so my left front went over his left rear, you know, opposite direction. And I got launched about 6 feet up for about 30 feet and then came down nose first. And I remember thinking in my head, oh man, don't long dart. Because I was really worried it was going to just stop.
Yeah.
But thankfully, it did not just stop. It slid. And as soon as it started sliding, I jumped on the brakes and the brake pedal went to the floor. And I thought, what the hell? And then I realized that the left front was not attached to the car anymore.
Yep.
I'm like, oh, well, that's where the brake fluid went. All right. So I slid through the desert for what felt like, you know, 10 minutes before the car finally came to a stop. So the Titan was very twisted and very, very broken. I remember sitting there thinking, you know, before the corner worker signaled me, I could get out. Man, can we get this back together for tomorrow? but as I'm sitting there, I noticed that the windscreen was broken, that you could only see a very little bit of the windscreen in the Titan. But that was broken. And that's when it kind of hit me that this was a bigger hit than, you know, than something we're going to get, you know, put back together overnight.
Yeah.
So just at that time, I had also acquired a Lotus 69 Formula Ford, which a lot of people know is regarded as the high watermark, really a vintage Formula Ford.
Yeah.
Like everything I acquired was through a, you know, a horse trading deal. And it needed a complete restoration. So I decided to focus on that first. And make it right and get it together and get it racing before I got the Titan back together. So I got the 69 together, raced it twice, wonderful car, absolutely, you know, quick and nimble and everything you could want from a Formula Ford. But I didn't feel comfortable pushing it that hard because it's worth at least twice as much as any other Formula Ford that exists.
Yeah.
And so after running it twice, I thought, well, that was fun. Let's sell this one and get the Titan back together. So I sold it, got the Titan back together. Actually, when I sold the Lotus 69, I sold it for cash and also a Crosley 40 was in the trade, which I never actually saw the car. I mean, I saw pictures of it, but it was on the East Coast at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal was that the Titan was almost back together, but I told the guy, all right, you have 6 months to get it out to me, because I wasn't planning to do anything with it real quickly.
Yeah.
About 3 months later, he called me back and said, you know what, I changed my mind. I made a mistake. I want the 40 back. So I sold it back to him. So I owned that car for 3 months and never saw it. And then 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, I acquired another Titan Mark VI. Because as you know, as you run a car, you acquire a lot of spares for it and different things. And a Titan Mark VI showed up for a very reasonable price with a PRS body on it. And it was an old SCCA car, and you know, the guy had done a lot of quote unquote upgrades to it that were, you know, had devalued it greatly.
Yeah.
So I bought it, and my dad and I spent time putting it back together to a proper Titan Mark VI. Sold it to a guy. It's actually, last I heard, it's Art Hebert has it, who's another very quick Titan racer, and that's the car that he keeps for his son to race.
Got it.
So it's good to see that car still around.
Yeah. Well, very cool. So you've had your hand in many a seat. So that's pretty rad.
Yeah. And then the other highlight before I forget is, a mutual friend of ours, Barry Blackmore, owns the very first ADS ever made, and he let me take it out and do a test session in it at one point, which was really cool, just you know, knowing how much of a game changer that car was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always enjoyed coming up to and passing an ADF because it's so wonderful to look at, and then also going, I just passed an ADF. That's something not too many people in period could say. So,
yep.
That's very cool. So, which car out of the Fords that you've run have you enjoyed the most? And to piggyback on that, which one maybe wasn't your favorite and or hard to work on?
So my favorite is just my Mark VI. Mm-hmm. You know, it and I, we've spent 10 years together now, and I can do anything I want with that car. I know exactly how it's going to respond, which is how I'm able to be, you know, as successful as I am right now with it. It's just good quality seat time.
Yeah.
I run it on, you know, a bunch of different tires because of all the different changing tire rules and learned, you know, what it likes and what it doesn't and how to make it work. And so it's just my favorite. And it's probably become one of those cars now that I'm never going to get rid of just because I've spent so many enjoyable times, you know, thrashing it around and beating on it and, you know, driving it on the edge. And that was the other actual thing that I had to learn when I started racing Formula Ford. This is a moment I'll never forget. My first Formula Ford race, coming into turn three at Willow on lap three, or maybe it was four, and I'd never realized that I had learned this until I had to unlearn it, but in the Lotus it was so fragile that what I'd learned to do was go out and do three or four really hard laps at the beginning of a race and then back off a little bit, mm-hmm. just to try and get the car to the finish line. So I remember coming into turn three, getting ready to, you know, do the downshifts and turn left, and I thought, okay, you've done four hard laps, back it down, and try and get the car to the finish. And I thought, wait a second, no, this is a purposeful race car, I don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah.
I can just push, I can just go. And I did, and, you know, the car most of the time makes it to the finish, but that's what it was designed to do.
Yeah.
So the, you know, I've never found a Formula Ford that I don't like out of all the ones I've driven.
Mm-hmm.
I will say the oddest one I did one day in Dulong that's owned by Todd Strong, because he had to leave and we were trying to keep the car count up. And I wasn't racing that weekend, so he said, hey, will you know, step in my car and run it? I said, absolutely. And that is not an attractive car, first off. And second off, you know, the shift length didn't have the feel that I was looking for. But, you know, I don't really know that there's a bad Formula Ford out there. And as for hard to work on, the neat thing about purposeful race cars is that they're made to be worked on. And that's something that I love about them, is you can get to everything. And if there's something that you can't get to and you don't like it, you can fix it. You can change it.
Mm-hmm.
When I first got my Titan, in order to do a gear change, which, as you know, for the Formula Ford, you change gears between every race, and sometimes at the track as well. You had to take off the battery box and the exhaust hanger in order to change gears. And that just annoyed me, that you have to go through that extra step when you know how to do it. So I remounted the battery in a different way so you don't have to move it, and remounted the exhaust hanger just so that when you're doing gears, all you have to do is pull the gears out. And that's the neat thing about purposeful race cars, is you can make it so that maintenance is easy and how you want it to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm right with you that as we're doing our Eldon build right now, I don't think Eldons in the day were built for someone of my size.
Mm-hmm.
And even my arm length, where the shifter's at, we actually had to lower all of the joints, if you will, in the shifting mechanism, had to lower them all in the car so I could have a shorter throw. Otherwise, I'm hitting dash with my knuckles. And
mm-hmm.
while I enjoy bloody knuckles, and that's a fun game for everyone who's 7 years old, I'm a bit beyond that by now. But to your point, you know, we've made little changes to the car. Then, okay, they didn't come off the assembly line at the factory that way. But we're also 45, 50 years on from when these cars were built. You also have to make them easy to work on so you can actually enjoy your weekend. And if you can make something easier for yourself, let's say I get hit by a truck tomorrow and the car's for sale, that's then going to be easier for somebody, if they're getting into the sport, to understand and work on the car. And that's one thing. I mean, I love a good barn find as much as anyone, but there's the 30 or 40 years of missed user-friendly changes that have been, you know, not added to the equation that you miss. And obviously, with the restorations that you do, the ones we do, you always look at how can we make this advanced, but not advanced in a way where we're you know, changing pickup points and things of that nature. So, and even on the Eldon per se, it actually had updated pickup points from running in the 80s, and then during its solo career, which I've been told that quite a few cars get butchered up a bit for their solo careers. But the pickup points are a good 6 inches out of factory, and it's like whoa, we gotta roll this down, get it back into being an Eldon again. So that's been interesting. Okay, so you know and love Formula Ford. You still race it today. You've obviously raced some really, really cool production cars, but you've also raced, and I believe own, two very well-known Formula 5000 rides. Let us kind of get the backstory on that and what it's like to drive those beasts.
Sure. So the two 5000 cars, owned by my father, I should clarify. I'm very lucky. But we have Danny and Gaius's Lola T332C, and the C after stands for continuation. It doesn't mean it was made, you know, now or in the 90s or something. Mm-hmm. It means that it was built in 75 after the teams couldn't figure out how to make the Lola T400 work. Everybody called Lola and complained and said, what did you do? You screwed everything up. And so Lola said, all right, here's the deal. We'll start making 332s again if everybody liked them. And so this was, Interscope Racing bought this for Danny to run. And it was his late 75 and 1976 car. Amazingly enough, for a Danny and Gaius car, it still has the original top with no dings to it. And the car is actually in very, very, as it was conditioned, still got the original paint from 76. Wow. And the tub still what it was and everything. So it's absolutely immaculate, and always draws a crowd whenever, you know, we have it out. Mm-hmm. And the way we got that was Ted Field gave it to Danny after it was done with useful life. Danny sold it to Vashek Polak. And this is actually a pretty entertaining story. So Vashek's guys got it running, but they had left water sit in it, and this might have been when Danny had it, or, you know, who knows what the timeline was, but the magnesium intake runners for the mechanical fuel injection, when it has water set against it, it corrodes badly. So they got the car together, fired it up, water comes pouring out of the exhaust. Vashek Polak just happens to walk in at that time, and he was never a fan of anything with an American motor in it. And so he said, oh, park that piece of shit, and they put it up in the rafters, and there it sat until we were given the opportunity to buy it. So we bought it and did a full mechanical restoration on it, but leaving the body exactly as it was and everything. And that car is incredible. Another car I have is a 1972 Chevron B24, which is has had a much rougher life. it's not the original tub. It's had various small shunts and everything. Nothing major, thankfully. But it's been a race car for, you know, it's been raced heavily for years and years, including by my father and myself. But it is just a joy to drive, and both the 5000 cars are just incredible. The neat thing about them, though, is that they don't feel that unlike a Formula Ford, and that's really kind of the cool thing about it. Is I can jump from the Formula Ford into, especially the Chevron. The Chevron feels almost exactly like my Titan, except for that right pedal does a lot more. and that's the neatest thing about a 5000 car. The only way I can describe it is, on the old Star Treks when they go into warp speed and the stars would stretch. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what driving a 5000 car feels like. Stuff that is in front of you is behind you almost faster than you can process. But the braking, turn in, mid corner, all that feels a lot like a Formula Ford, which I think is one of the reasons that back in the day somebody could go from Formula Ford to upper echelons of motorsports in, you know, a couple of years. The cars really, the design philosophy was the same, and it all was a very natural progression.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just so cool. And it's funny. Okay, so you have an Angaius car. I have an Angaius piece of a car, that being a chassis tag from, I think it's a, and it's not in front of me right now, I believe it's a 85 March, the one he barrel rolled at Michigan that year, for the Michigan 500. So, and it's one of those things, I feel like he's gotten a very bad rap because of some incidents that occurred to him. I mean, he wasn't always the cause of his shunts. Even his inaugural IndyCar race, the 1976 Cal 500, which was September of 76, there were two rookies in that race that had notable histories. He was one, and he actually backflipped, or I believe he barrel rolled a Parnelli chassis in that race. The other rookie in that race was Rick Mears, driving Art Sugai's Eagle Offie. And I know that one really well. But it's one of those things. Danny was faster by light years. He also had better equipment that day. He had, instead of running a six-year-old Eagle, he had a brand new Parnelli that Ted bought him. But he just had the most unfortunate career with things that went on. And I think the was that the 87 Indy 500, the year where he crashed out in practice with a joint Penske car, and then the guy who goes and fills in for him is Al Unser, and he goes and wins his fourth Indy 500. I mean, again, the unlucky breaks that Danny Angaius had, I feel have marred him so bad in history in terms of, oh, well, he's a crasher. He'd go flat out and crash. Yeah, but when he went flat out, good luck. You're not catching him. You can have your Star Trek.
Exactly.
You can have your Star Trek vision trying to keep up with him. You're not going to get it. He was the man on so many levels. So.
Yeah. No, he was absolutely incredible. And when he was on it, I mean, nobody could touch him.
Right.
And reading some of the things he talked about, you know, the way he thought about cars, and I think his early drag racing career helped him in certain respects, especially with the 5,000 cars, because they were, you know, not very unlike a dragster, honestly. But, you know, you'd hear him talk about getting the car up on the tires and making the tires work and everything, and I think that a lot of that comes back to how he came up through the sport.
Wonderful. So you do much of your own work on your cars, right down to the frame-up, restoration, and builds. I know you're currently working on a Le Grand Mark VI that we were both tracking at one point before you wound up with. What do you find most rewarding regarding your restorations, and what can you offer our listeners out there as to things to avoid and focus on for doing their work, especially those just starting out in Formula Ford action?
Sure. So like you say, I do most of my own work. I don't do motors. But pretty much everything else we are able to keep in-house between my dad and I.
Mm-hmm.
That Le Grand Mark VI Formula B car. I've always had a passion for Formula B cars as well. With the Lotus, I spent a lot of time, you know, around a Lotus Twin Cam. I think that was one of the best motors in the entire world. So having, you know, pretty much a Formula Ford with wide tires and a Lotus Twin Cam in it is, in my mind, has always been just incredible. The tough thing about Formula B right now is it doesn't have nearly the following or the level of competitiveness that Formula Ford does. So that's something I keep, you know, asking myself as I'm putting this Formula B car together. What are you going to do with it when you're, you know, done with it? Are you going to run it once and then be like, well, now I go back to the Ford because there's people to race with and it's competitive. So I don't know, but I've always wanted a Formula B car, and I'm gosh darn it, I'm going to get it. You know, as you mentioned with autocross earlier, this was an autocross car, and it had a rough life and was pretty hammered, so it needs a lot of work. But we're going to make it right. We're going to do it right. And that's, I guess, giving people advice for how to, you know, do their own Formula Fords. The neat thing about Formula Fords is it is not uncommon for a guy to do it himself, to be able to take care of it in his garage, bring it to the track, hopefully bring his family out with him, and you know, do it all himself. And that's, you know, kind of what I pride myself on, always having the family with me.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I was raised in the sport. But in order to make that successful, the most important thing, in my opinion, it's what gets missed a lot, is spending time with the car and on the car.
Yes.
These are purposeful race cars. A lot of people see that and think, okay, well, it's a purposeful race car, so all it should do is have to race. All I have to do is put gas in it. But it being a purposeful race car, it's also, you know, 40 or 50 years old. So what you need to do between every race, what my mantra is take the body work all completely off, get it down to the bare frame, get a paper towel, put WD-40 on it, wipe off every single suspension component, every single, you know, corner of the car, look for any cracks or bends or anything, do the same with the frame, I don't know if you need the WD-40 on the frame, but at least wipe off everything, and just look for anything funny. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing to do, is just spend time with it and get to know it, because that way you will, you know, learn what the car needs, because a lot of them have, you know, a weak point where there is a certain bolt that's sort of overstressed and tends to come loose, you know, every other race.
Mm-hmm.
So as you get to know that, you get more comfortable with it, and you're able to, one, know what to touch, and two, you're able to diagnose things much quicker when you're there doing it. So that's my big advice. I personally hate working on cars at the track. You know, you're out in the elements, it's windy or it's sunny or it's cold. And so my goal when I get to the track is to not work on the car at all, aside from putting fuel in it or changing tires if I need to.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get there. I want to go race. I want to, you know, sit around and have a beer at the end of the day and not do much else on the car. So that's my thing, is get the car work done at home, spend the time with the car at home, and go out and have a very successful weekend where you're not having to scramble and try and fix the car in between sessions.
Yeah, and it's funny. Everyone I know that has that same mentality enjoys racing a lot, because the weekend is for the racing and the week is for the preparation. Those who I know who seem to do the exact opposite generally aren't in the sport long, because they find nothing about it enjoyable and all about it frustrating. And it's like, well, just you need to just regroup, look at your timeline. If you move your timeline back and actually come to the race prepared, everything's organized, as we learned in our last episode with Steve Beeler, you might find all this just absolutely breathtaking, and it might change your outlook on a lot of things in life.
Mm-hmm.
So besides the LeGrand Mark VI, what other cars are you currently working on or in the midst of restoring?
So I've got a long list of projects I acquire things as I go. But right now I'm putting together a streetcar launch, another one that my dad and I came upon that was in very rough condition, sitting in a backyard for 20-something years. So putting that together, putting together a 26R that's not mine, that's for someone else. And then after I get through that, next on deck is a Brubaker box restoration that is very near and dear to my heart. And it's interesting to see that the Brubaker box has recently gained a lot of interest, or at least in the circles I run, and it seems to be gaining momentum. That's near and dear to my heart because my dad actually designed that when he worked for Kurt Brubaker back in the early 70s. That was a design that actually came straight out of his Art Center graduation portfolio when he graduated. And Kurt had hired him and found the design, and they started kicking around how to do it and put it almost into production before the VW deal went sideways, and then the molds were sold off to Auto Mecca to produce kit cars. So I have one of the kit cars that's in really rough condition, again, sitting in a backyard for 20-something years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's next on there. And then I've got a interesting project called a FiberFab Centurion, which, again, a kit car manufacturer, FiberFab, made a copy of the Mitchell Stingray, which was the prototype model for the C2 Corvette. After GM released the C2 Corvette, FiberFab said, yeah, that's kind of neat, but that, you know, the Mitchell Stingray was really, really way cooler. So they made about 10 of them. GM called him up and said, no, that's our design. You better cut it out. Cease and desist. So they got shopped, but one of the bodies that was never put together, never done anything with, I came across that. I got it from the same guy that had the Brubaker box. So that car my son has already decided is his. And he's only five, but he's on me all the time. When are we going to get my Corvette going? So
yeah,
that's got to move up the list because he's insistent on it.
Yeah, and that's so cool. So I have a love of Devons and also the Wildwood Wildfires, made most famous by the great movie. Look it up; it's on YouTube. Johnny Dark. There's just something about that time frame, and especially the early fiberglass cars. Where the limitations, there were none. You just went for it and made something exotic, and you know what looked good to your eye, and especially the ones that weren't produced in very large numbers. I just absolutely adore. So it's really cool that you're working on some things that fit in that ballpark.
Fiberglass is near and dear to my heart. You know, being a Lotus guy, I'm learning about fiberglass. So, I have the same love you do of the weird creations that were made throughout the years.
Yeah. I do have to take a moment to pause. I actually just got a text message from a gentleman who loves Formula Ford racing. If you own Winkelmann WD1 with a logbook number stamped in your roll hoop of 19-953, send me an email. We have some documentation to send you. All right, we're back. So Todd, what do you find most magnetic about Formula Ford racing, especially in your native state in California? I know you are literally in the hotbed of FF activity from north to south.
Yeah, I'm really lucky to be involved in it. You know, like I said, it was something that I really wanted to do, and I jumped in with both feet. But it has paid me back in spades. And what always interested me about it was the community. Mm-hmm. We do a big barbecue Saturday nights with our club, at least, for all the Formula Ford racers. And it's this community. You race each other, you know, very hard. As hard as it gets in vintage racing, I guess, is the best way it could be put. We also have the mentality that we, you know, don't want to ding anything.
Right.
But other than that, you're only giving each other a paper's thickness of room to make it work. But then at the end of the day, we all sit around and have a beer. And growing up at the track, that was something that was really important to me, mm-hmm. was to make sure to stay with a group where it was a family atmosphere.
Right.
Where I could bring my kids and they would, identify, Kim Madrid as Aunt Kim and Eric Inkrod as Uncle Eric. Just because it's family. So that's what drew me to it. But the other neat thing with my engineering mind, what I really love about Formula Ford is getting to see how human invention and human perseverance carries on through technology, because the rules stayed so stable for so long. I think the longest of any class, maybe Formula B would rival that, but you can look at the very early cars, say a Lotus 51, which was the height of technology, kinda then, and then see a very rapid progress from that Lotus 51 to my Titan Mark VI, which was designed in 1970. So in those 5 years, the car changed a huge amount.
Mm-hmm.
And then you line up, a Club Ford there too, and Club Ford's always kind of interesting because there were so many different ideas going on then. So many people trying to invent a better mousetrap, and a lot of ideas that maybe weren't as appealing to the eye.
Mm-hmm.
But then you look at the next era, and you move into the modern Fords. And that was, you look at some of those, and you look at a Swift DB1, it's still competitive today, in top level running is the newest stuff, which is honestly amazing.
Right.
But also I think, somebody who I'm a very big fan of, is David Bruns, who, we talked about the ADF already. He was the designer of that. And then, designer of the Swift, and I always kind of joke that our whole class structure, you know, the Vantage Ford, Club Ford, Modern Ford thing is set up around whenever he came up with a new idea, because we had Vintage Ford, and then he came up with the ABF, and when the ABF debuted is when it jumps to Club Ford now, mm-hmm. and then 10 years later, he drew something new, which was the Swift DB1, and they went, oh, Swift's out, now it's Modern Ford. So I think he deserves a lot of credit. But there were so many designers and you know, revolutionary thinkers, Adrian Renard, you know, people like that who had a welder and you know, had an idea. And that's something that I think is missing a little bit in current racing, is the idea that you can, in your garage, make something and then go out and rival, you know, anybody else. Mm-hmm. And that was an era. And then one of the reasons I really like vintage is it's a celebration of an era when, you know, everybody who wanted to could just come race and try their hand at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed in full. Okay. Tomorrow you win the lottery, but the lottery says that your first X amount has to go towards picking the Formula Ford of your dreams. What's that going to be?
I absolutely love my Titan, so that's, you know, that's always...
So you're not going to spend any money, are you?
I'm trying to caveat this a little bit.
Yeah.
That car comes first for me, mm-hmm. Because I think it's one of the prettiest Formula Fords around. But something that's always really had a soft spot for me was the 94-95 Citation.
Mm.
Which is, yeah, honestly not a very well-known car. I don't think they made a huge number of them. But just the lines of it strike me as you know, very akin to an Indy car from that era, which is, you know, what I grew up watching on TV with, mm-hmm. you know, Al Jr. racing in Valvoline colors or Penske colors. And that was, you know, very Formula One. So I've always thought that was one of the neatest Formula Fords around. And if I was going to go in a different direction, that would probably be it. Though I have to probably give honorable mention to that store that they created. I think they made two of that has the raised nose and mm-hmm. the radiator that sits under the driver's feet. I think that, you know, a lot of advanced thinking went into that, and I probably didn't get the development or the support it needed to run at the front. Though I'm sure, looking at the design, it should be more than capable of it.
I would think so. If that car got in the right or wrong hands, I think it could be a world beater.
Yeah, I agree.
So you've been racing for a while. Out of the hundreds of Formula Ford drivers you've seen in your time, are there a few that maybe stick out in your mind as being underappreciated or perhaps lost in time due to the fact that they didn't make it professionally?
I've had the privilege of racing with a lot of really incredible guys. You know, Steve O'Hara, every time he comes out is nearly unbeatable.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he can answer that question, because he did have a decently successful professional career. You know, somebody that always stuck out to me was a friend of mine, Barry Blackmore,
mm-hmm.
Who started in Formula Ford and climbed to the ranks up to Formula 5000 and period. And then you know, had a fairly serious wreck in a Lagrange Formula 5000 car that you actually have some personal connection to.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he stepped back from racing for a while and concentrated on his day job, and then got into vintage racing later in life. But he always really impressed me at his ability to always be on the button.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, in a Formula 5000 car, that's where I ran against him the most, was in 5000 cars. And there was one Friday test session, we were out there, and I'd been running all morning and really felt like I was, you know, making progress to get ready for the weekend. And he, you know, had some teething issues in the morning. So finally, in the first afternoon session, he comes out, and he and I go out with him right behind me. And I thought, man, I'm going to walk away from him, because, you know, this is his first lap of the weekend, and I'm warmed up and ready to go. And so for the first two laps, he was right on my tail, you know, in an annoying sense. So I finally pointed him by, and thought, all right, I'll follow him around and annoy him, and he just walked away from me, and this is, you know, his third and fourth lap of the weekend.
Wow.
And so for him to just be on the button like that all the time really, really impressed me. So he's the guy, though. He did have some professional success that I really kind of think is an inspiration.
Very cool. Out of all your races, if there's one that sticks out to be what you think to be your greatest race, what would that be?
The one that I'm, it's funny because the one that I'm probably the most proud of is one that I didn't win. Was the 50th anniversary of Formula Ford at Willow Springs, which was done just over a year ago. You know, there were a lot of big 50th celebrations last year, which was absolutely wonderful.
Right.
But the Willow Springs was where the first Formula Ford race was held in 1969, so getting to do the 50th there was really cool. And you know, like we talked about before with the Formula Ford, and the reason I love the class so much is we're all running together. You know, the Lotus 51 all the way up to, I think the newest car there that weekend was a 2000 Van Diemen.
Mm-hmm.
And immaculately prepped as well, and very well driven. But we all get to run together and kind of see what happens and you know how technology has or sometimes didn't work out for a new design. But in the Saturday race there, I qualified I think sixth or so out of you know the 30 something cars that were there, and climbed all the way up to second behind that 2000 Van Diemen. Which was pretty incredible for one of the oldest cars in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just hammered on him and hammered on him. I couldn't get by him. Just, you know, the aerodynamics that he has over me were, you know, light years better.
Yeah.
So I never made it around him, but I was quick enough through the corners that I hassled him really, really well. And had a great race and had a lot of fun. And then afterwards came in, and you know, it was a big 50, and so there were a lot of marquee names there. And guys like Alan Hawley and Paul Fanner and David Bruns was there, and Steve Nicklaus. And afterwards, the amount of people that came up and shook my hand and said, man, that was so much fun to watch. Great drive. That was probably my high watermark in my Formula Ford career, I have to say. Just getting to meet those people even and to have them coming to me to say I'd driven a great race was phenomenal.
Yeah, that's pretty rad. So if we look forward, where do you feel the sport of racing is headed in the future?
That's a difficult question to answer. You know, it's a crystal ball type of thing. The good news is, I think, you know, our club level racing, the stuff we do, is really kind of at a golden era right now. And hopefully we can build on that. I mean, especially the Formula Ford class. So the resurgence I've seen since I've been in it these last 10 years has been phenomenal. And I hope we can keep building on that and people keep, you know, realizing how much fun it is and especially how affordable it is and how everyman it is. And that's the neat thing about it is you can have a professional prep shop that's also taking care of Formula One cars, you know, prep your Formula Ford, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Or you can, you know, haul it out on your open trailer behind, you know, I've used my wife's Ford Flex at times to haul my open trailer with my Formula Ford on it. And you can do that and come out and have a good weekend and sleep in the back of your truck. And not, you know, depending on how much work you put in, there won't be really any difference between the two. So club-wise, I think the sport is in wonderful shape. You know, professional-wise, who knows what we see on the horizon with, you know, and especially now with what is happening, you know, in the world.
Right.
If manufacturer interest is going to stay up in it, if electric racing is the wave of the future, I don't know. But I feel very secure with what we're doing and where it's going. And I'm really proud of the fact that vintage racing, you know, for a long time, vintage racing was kind of laughed at as parade laps. And there are certain people that are just doing that, you know, going out and running laps. But there are a lot of very, very quick people who, you know, possibly had, you know, SECA experience or professional experience or even haven't and have just spent enough years in vintage racing that they are darn quick and are racing at 10 tenths, all while leaving the little bit of extra room that you do in vintage so that everybody can put a car on the trailer at the end of the weekend in the same shape they brought it to the track at. So
yeah,
that makes me happy.
What would you recommend for someone who's looking at Formula Ford as a first race car?
My best advice would be find something you think is pretty.
Yeah.
I know it sounds silly, but find something that really excites you, that you really like looking at. And that's what I did with the Titan, though it is also known for being a very successful car. But don't worry about if the car was successful in period or even is successful now. Because we have the technology now and there's enough smart people out there that we can honestly make any car fast at this point.
Yeah.
You know, if it was a fairly evil car in the day or not well loved or whatever, if you want to invest the time in it, you can be at the front in absolutely any car you can find. So just find something that stirs you, that gets you excited, that you want to work on. And that's going to be the best for you because, you know, racing is about, you know, you got to put a lot of effort into it.
Right.
So make sure it's something that you want to put the effort into.
Right. And I agree with that all around. And your point of find a car that you think is pretty, that's kind of how we found the Eagle. We were obviously way into Eagles at that point with our vintage Indy fleet. But then I started looking at the research and, okay, well, David Loring won the 78 runoffs. Well, that's cool. But no one else did a damn thing with them. And I'm going, well, either David Loring was really good, which he was. Update, we're going to have a podcast just about David Loring coming up soon where a lot of his friends and family are going to chime in. Or this car was just kind of underwhelming. And I got into it and right away I was like, well, it fits me perfectly. And to that point, you never know the quality of a field. You don't know how good a driver is or how much they're into it or put into it. When you look at old results sheets, you really historically can't get a good judgment of that. And with our build of the Eldon right now, well, the Eldons were very successful in the UK. There was some really good shoes that got in them here in the United States, Alan Holly being one, Danny Sullivan over in the UK and over here, as well as Tom Pompelli, who raced in Eldon at the runoffs twice and had some pretty good finishes. But overall, there weren't any national championships won by an Eldon, but I honestly feel, and even though I don't think the Eldon is as pretty as the Eagle, I think we can make that car quicker because it was very underdeveloped. And we're finding things in the car and the way we're setting it up where it's like, well, if we set it up as we found it, that's in bind, this is in shear, this you know, water line is right next to the hottest part of the car. Let's fix all of this and maybe we can make this thing fly. So to your point, anyone, we can make a formula if the right minds get together, or even a somewhat right mind, you can make any Formula Ford out there a fast car. But I would highly recommend something you think is pretty because that looks better on a Christmas card. So
exactly. Now I do want to, you know, clarify that stance as well, though. I'm not saying take a 1970 car and completely reconfigure it and change it
right
to, you know, to running Swift, you know, A-arms or something like that. One of the things my dad was famous for saying was, remember, we're racing these cars how they were, not how we wished they were. So I'm a big stickler for period correct. But even within the confines of period correct, you can still make any car work for you. But at the same time, you know, the tirade I've been on recently actually is mirrors. when I got my Titan, it had, you know, modern formula car mirrors on it, which is what you see most of the time.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that one. Yep.
Yeah, and I, during the past restoration of the Titan, I went back to Talbot mirrors, which cost a bundle of money. Mm-hmm. Not gonna lie. And they don't have quite the viewing angle of the modern Formula car mirrors, but I will say I'm talking to the guy that makes them right now, and he's going to do me a development set that have more fisheye to them, so we can try and develop a mirror, because that's the feedback I've got a lot of times, oh, you can't see out of them. So I'm trying to move that needle to make the mirrors work better.
Yeah.
And then I really want to go on a campaign to get people to put period correct mirrors on the car, because that's one thing that I can't stand right now is if you see all these immaculately prepped Formula Fords and they're all running, you know, mirrors that were created in 1995 or whenever it was.
Yeah.
So that's my little soapbox.
Yeah, and that's okay. And it's funny you say that. I actually found an original Eagle Formula Ford mirror last year. And Paul, my mechanic, and I studied it for about an hour. And we basically came to the conclusion, we don't know how Rem and the boys at AAR made it, because it is just dynamite. And we know, you know, the little Formula mirrors that we have on the Eagle that look like they came off a 95 Van Diemen. We know it's not correct, and you know, we'll get there. Todd, for you, I'll get there. But it's going to take some doing. So.
Sure. And I don't want everybody to, you know, go in the garage and rip their mirrors off tonight. I would just like to put it out there that, you know, as it comes up, if you break a mirror, you know, maybe think about not reordering the same one. Maybe think about putting something on that's a little more period correct.
Yeah, I mean, it's bad enough we all have stupid onboard cameras that look totally out of place on our cars. But yeah, I know where you're coming. I know where you're coming.
At least the onboard cameras keep getting smaller, so they're getting less apparent.
This is true.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Todd, thank you for joining us on Kentish today. I know it was on late notice. You were on my list for 2020, so don't think you weren't going to be coming on Kentish this year.
Good.
But due to someone else's unavailability to make it today, you got called up to the big leagues. So
I appreciate that, and I appreciate what you're doing for the sport. You know, we need things like this. We need to celebrate what we're doing because we're having a lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly.
I think if more people knew about it, you know, we'd grow the sport even more. And it's such an open and inclusive sport.
Yeah.
That more people need to know about it and. You know, my goal, every time there's a new guy, there's a rookie, mm-hmm. I make sure to go up and shake his hand and say, hey, I appreciate you being here. Whatever you need, you know, let us know. We're here to help as a family atmosphere.
Right.
So the more people that see that and the more people that we can get out, you know, I'm all for it.
Right. And it's funny. So this whole Kentish project, I kind of look at it as I'm taking a audio account of kind of an index card of individuals. And who they are now in the sport. Who there's a guest I have coming on very soon, who's never been interviewed, but he was one of the top five drivers from about 1974 to 78 in Formula Ford. To kind of talk about his time in the sport, I'm just trying to catalog people. And I started this at the beginning of the whole COVID deal. I didn't really know how long we'd all be confined, and I figured, well, yeah, I'm getting a little sick and tired of not talking to anyone. So why don't I talk to some people that I maybe not normally? And if we can make racing happen in some way, shape, or form, let's go for it. Now, I say that right now. There's two vintage races going on this weekend within an hour and a half of me. SVRA is running at Road America, and I know some of your friends from California are at that. And then VSTDA is running at Blackhawk this weekend. And between those two races, there's close to 30 Formula Fords running. I'm not running because we didn't have that either one of those races on our schedule this year. But man, I'm itching and I can't wait to get out there. And I know that as things roll along here in 2020, again, my goal is about 43 interviews this year. This will be number 9. But I'm going to start doing about 2 a week if I can find the time to kind of pull in and make people realize that, hey, we're all a bunch of just like-minded people in some sense. At least we have this in common, that we all love Formula Ford racing. So, with that being said, Todd, for those who might be interested, you know, in your work, maybe check out Restoration Photos or You on Track. Where can they find you?
Sure. So I've got Facebook and Instagram pages going. Facebook is just Todd Gerstenberger, mm-hmm. And search carefully because my dad of the same name is also on there, and his profile picture is a picture of me and him and my son, the 3 generations. So. You know, watch out for that. Not that his page isn't great too. It's got a fair amount of car stuff on, but the Facebook page is probably more family-oriented. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of pictures of my kids and stuff, which, you know, if you want to see that, you're welcome to as well. But the Instagram page, I try and keep a little more car-centric.
Yeah.
And the username there is ABO West, which is our restoration shop. That's the name of it, ABO West. So go ahead and look that up, or you can search by my name, and try and update on the neat and weird things that we stumble on and get to work on.
Awesome, Todd. Well, I appreciate it. And usually I do a beginning and a close to these episodes, but I think we'll just call it what it is right now. I'm going to make one more announcement. Again, whoever has Winkelmann WD-1 with a logbook number of 19-953, contact me. We have your logbook. So I had a friend in the middle of this podcast message me and say, hey, this was in a toolbox I acquired, and there's probably a car out there that's missing its logbook. So,
yeah.
Hey, if we can do that, I'd say it was a double win for this podcast. So,
totally agree.
Awesome, Todd. Thank you so much.
Yep, thank you.
All right.
Again soon.
Cheers.
Bye.